do is call the meeting of the Transportation Committee to order, but I guess it's not that anymore. We'll call the, to order the House Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee, and I welcome the members here this morning. And first thing on the agenda is to adopt the rules. I'd entertain a motion.
So moved.
Representative Schaffler moves we adopt the rules of the committee. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? If none, they're adopted. And let's start with introductions, and I'll start with Representative Shields down on this end, and tell us a little bit about yourself, your district, and any expectations you might have of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I represent North Northeast Portland District 43, and has a district with that borders on some manufacturing areas that I'm interested in, the living wage jobs there. I started an outfit called Better People in North Northeast Portland that is a job placement organization, and so that has given me some insight into workforce development issues, and I look forward to using that experience here on the committee.
Thank you, Representative Schaffler.
Mike Schaffler, Happy Valley, Southeast Portland. I hope we do things here to attract investment, create jobs, and generate revenue.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Representative Sal Esquivel from Medford area, looking forward to this. This is business, and I've been a small business owner for almost all my life, or I manage some veneer plants and sawmills. I had 110 people working for me at one time at age 31. So looking forward to what we can accomplish through business, labor, and, of course, consumer affairs. And I do have some issues with consumer affairs. I've dropped some bills on consumer protection that will be coming forth, and hopefully it'll come to this committee.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Holt.
Yes, my name is Paul Holby. I'm from South Eugene, South Central Lane County in District 8. And my background's in the construction industry. I've been a small business owner before, independent contractor, and also a carpenter for the Carpenters Union. And I'm looking forward to creating jobs in this state.
Representative Gilman.
Tardy Representative Gilman is from District 55, east of Medford, goes clear over to Lakefield, to Prineville, all of Lake, all of Crook County, northern half of Klamath County, and about a third of Jackson County, and a little bit of Deschutes County thrown in. Very happy to be on this committee. I'm looking forward to good economic development. Finally, it looks like Oregon's turning around. What we need to do is keep that momentum going.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Derek Kitts. I represent House District 30, all of Washington, or not, it's all in Washington County. Hillsborough, North Plains, Beaverton, Rock Creek, parts of Forest Grove, and parts of Portland. So it's good to be back on the committee. Able chair, able committee. Good time.
Thank you, Representative. We need to introduce the two most important people on the committee, Janet.
Janet Atkins. My first session here was the 1987 session, and I'm happy to be doing the Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee. And I grew up in Medford, went to U of O, and have been here, started this job when my kids were small. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Katie?
I'm Katie Hauer.
Thank you, committee. Did you hand these out, Janet, to everyone? But that just for me to read to them, huh? You know, I've got a few procedural rules that I set down for a committee, and the number one right on the list was that we're going to start at 8:30 in the morning. And whenever the sessions start getting a little longer, we'll probably start at 8 o'clock in the morning. And
I strenuously object.
I noticed that already this morning. You vote with your feet, you know. And then I just ask that you let the committee staff know if you're not going to be here for the, can't make the committee meeting, so we can try to make sure we have a quorum here to conduct some business with. And we will routinely record your committee votes as excused instead of absence if you can't make it. We don't expect meetings to be ultra formal, but I would like to and expect that you direct the questions and answers through the chair, which most of you are very familiar with that. And we may need to have an occasional evening meetings as we go further down in the session if we smile. Represent kids to handle the business going to be put in the committee. We will, when we start voting on the bills, we'll use a rolling alphabetical roll call that will save Representative Escobar from having to be called first on every vote. And you'll each share that pleasure. And as the chair, I'll get to vote last. You will be expected to bring your own bills and files from the office for the from your office for the bills on the agenda for that day, so you want to be sure to have them with you when you come. Material from the committee staff will be at your place when you arrive in the morning, and if the material is routed to your office prior to the meeting so that you can look it over ahead of the meeting, it will be clearly marked so you can bring it with you to the meeting. And then, probably most importantly, remember that the cameras in the hearing room are on at all times, and that these mics are live, so when you carry on the conversation, you are on the air and being recorded. When the committee assistant turns the sound system on at the start of the meeting, Katie will give us a high sign that we are being recorded. And with that, is there any questions or comments in any of the committee? We'll get started into the... Janet, you want to give us a little briefing on our first...
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Members of the committee, this is an informational meeting beginning with an overview of the Department of Business and Consumer Services from the Director Corey Streisinger. And we are just taking one division of DCBS following that, the Building Codes Division. And then an overview of a separate department, the Employment Department, will follow that.
Thank you, Janet. Corey, would you like to start, please? Thank you very much for being here this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. And for the record, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, a position that I've held for exactly 2 years now. And I really appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning and give you a very brief overview of the department as a whole. And as your administrator indicated, it's my understanding that at least for several of our divisions, you will be getting more in-depth presentations from Building Codes this morning, I believe from Workers' Compensation on Monday, and Regulatory Streamlining on Wednesday. So I will try to keep my presentation at a very high level, but of course I'm happy to go into more detail on anything you'd like to hear about and to answer any questions, and then we will, of course, look forward to working with you as the session progresses. You should have a package of materials in front of you that looks like this, and I'm hoping that more materials will magically appear during the course of my testimony, but our photocopying is a little slower this morning than I would have liked, so I apologize for that. The Department of Consumer and Business Services is Oregon's largest business regulatory agency and consumer protection agency. Our mission is to protect and serve consumers and workers in Oregon while supporting a positive business climate. And those two halves of the mission, we actually regard them as complementary, not contradictory. We believe that a good regulatory system is one that works well and supports business as well as works well and protects consumers and workers. And that's what we really strive for, is to have a system which has broad support by all of our stakeholders, that protects consumers and workers and also provides businesses with a good place to do business. our major programs, and we, by the way, have very active stakeholder involvement in many of our programs, and many of the people in the room today, I believe, are stakeholders of various programs of ours, so we're happy to see them here today. Our major program areas are workers' compensation, Oregon OSHA, insurance, building codes, and finance and corporate securities. We also include the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Businesses, and the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. So I'm going to touch on each of those, again, at that fairly high-level overview. And in our materials, we have provided you with a contact sheet that tells you who our contact people are for each of those program areas and also summarizes for you the areas that they cover for your reference later as you're dealing with bills or with constituents. We've also provided you with a sampling of some of the informational brochures which we provide to consumers and businesses about what we do. And you will also see a summary of our legislative package and a card that tells you, again, what our programs are, what our mission is, and what the strategies are that we use to carry out our programs. I'd like to start with Oregon OSHA and workers' compensation, which, of course, are related. Oregon OSHA focuses on keeping workers safe. The workers' compensation division and other parts of our department that work in that area are focused on making sure that workers receive appropriate benefits and assistance in returning to work if they are injured. And as you may be aware, Oregon has experienced a record 15 years of declining or flat workers' compensation rates. At the same time, of course, we have seen a significant decrease in both the frequency and the severity of workplace injuries, which contributes heavily to that decline in rates. And we've also seen an improvement in benefits and in the ability to get workers back to work. And from just the brief overview that each of you gave of your backgrounds, I'm sure that's a story that many of you have some experience with. Through Oregon OSHA, we administer a state plan for occupational safety and health that must meet federal standards and be approved by the federal government. We promulgate health and safety rules and standards. We enforce those standards through inspections and through accident investigations. And in addition, we have consultation and training programs through which we work with employers and workers on a voluntary basis to help them make their workplaces safer. And our goal, and this is throughout Oregon OSHA, the enforcement side as well as the consultation side, is to have every encounter with the agency be a positive learning experience about workplace safety. As I mentioned, workplace injury and illness rates have continued to decline this biennium. We are, I believe, at a record low level this biennium. Severity has decreased as well. Some of our recent projects in Oregon OSHA during this interim have included a core rules manual aimed specifically at small businesses. If you ask for a copy of the Oregon OSHA rules, it's a large set. But the ones that a small business has to deal with every day, really to be in compliance, we've boiled down into a very small set, which is we hope, easy-to-read language, which is the sort of day-to-day functional tool that we expect to have out to small businesses quite shortly. We've also been focusing on educating employers about particularly the need to focus on safety for new workers. A very disproportionate number of accidents are for workers who are new on the job. Those injuries are preventable, and we'd like to help with that. And we've also done some significant expansion of our outreach and training materials for Spanish-speaking workers this biennium. In our workers' compensation division, we administer and enforce Oregon's workers' compensation laws to ensure that employers provide workers' compensation coverage and that workers who are injured get timely and appropriate and accurate benefits. We provide dispute resolution. We also oversee a number of programs aimed at helping workers return to work, either in their job that they held at the time of injury or, if necessary, through retraining and assistance with a new job. We work closely with the Management Labor Advisory Committee, which consists of equal numbers of employer representatives and worker representatives. I believe you're going to be hearing from them on Monday as well. And with them, we identify policy issues relating to workers' compensation and bring forward proposals for improvement. And through MLAC's work, you will be seeing this session three major sets of proposals, the first focusing on improving the vocational rehabilitation and return to work programs, the second proposing changes in the standards for determining and rescinding permanent total disability status, and the third addressing concerns about how independent medical exams are used. So all three of those packages are coming forward. Our department also provides administrative support to the Workers' Compensation Board, which is an independent adjudicatory agency that handles workers' compensation appeals, but we work very closely with the board. There are a lot of issues, of course, that we deal with in common having to do with records, and we also provide their administrative support, personnel, budgeting, purchasing, and things like that. And we also have two ombudsman's offices that are related to workers' compensation, a small business ombudsman who helps small businesses with coverage and premium issues, and an injured workers ombudsman that assists injured workers in working through the workers' compensation system and in helping them be treated fairly by those they work with. Our next major program area, again related to workers' compensation but much broader than that, is insurance. And we monitor insurance companies' financial status to ensure that they remain solvent so that they will be able to pay claims when needed. We ensure compliance with insurance laws and regulations aimed at fair treatment of the insurance-buying public. We monitor rates and forms filed by insurance companies, and we work with consumers to resolve insurance-related complaints. Among our projects this past interim, we worked on implementing last session's legislation which limited the use of credit scoring by insurance companies, which had been a major source of consumer complaints. There are still some concerns in that area, but the number of concerns and complaints we received has dropped off considerably as a result of that legislation, we believe. But we understand that there may be additional proposals coming forward on credit scoring this session as well. Another major area of consumer concern during the past few years has been how homeowners insurance companies make use of claims histories in deciding how to price and whether to offer homeowners insurance. And one of our bills this session addresses that issue, and you'll see it summarized in our package. An additional area of concern in the insurance area is the affordability and availability of insurance in a number of different areas, hard market areas in particular. When you hear the term hard market, insurance tends to go through cycles, and those tend to be national cycles. A hard market is characterized by insurance companies tightening up on underwriting, not insuring risks unless they are very good risks, and raising prices. A soft market part of the cycle is one where insurers are competing for the business. They tend to loosen underwriting standards and prices tend to go down. And we have been for the last few years nationally in a hard market cycle. And there are a number of areas where we have seen particularly acute difficult markets here in Oregon. They include contractors, construction contractors' liability insurance, where we have been working with the Construction Contractors Board and with stakeholders. We currently have in place something that's called a market assistance plan, which is one of the few tools available to us, actually, to address those types of issues, where we are attempting to match those who offer construction contractors insurance up with those who need it on a more efficient basis. One of our bills does address market assistance plans and another tool called joint underwriting agreements as well. We also, no surprise to any of you, I'm sure, are in a hard market in medical malpractice insurance. We have been working on implementation of last session's bill to provide relief to rural physicians. There are about 1,000 physicians who are currently receiving relief under that bill, but I'm sure you will be seeing proposals addressing medical malpractice issues as well this session. I think our next area is building codes, and I'm not intending to spend a lot of time on building codes today because Mark Long, administrator of the Building Codes Division, will be going over those areas in some depth. Our Building Codes Division is responsible for the adoption and interpretation of a consistent set of statewide building codes. We share permitting and inspection responsibilities with local jurisdictions in some areas. In other areas, we provide services statewide. And again, Mark will, I'm sure, be talking about that in more detail. Our final major division, and I know this is a lot of material, so I am trying to keep it fairly short in each of our areas. Our final major division is the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which includes a fairly wide variety of regulatory programs. We oversee state-chartered financial institutions, banks, and credit unions, and Oregon is regarded as a fairly healthy climate for local community state-chartered banks and credit unions. often a state-chartered bank can serve community needs in a way that a national bank might not. We oversee the state securities laws, and we have active enforcement in that area as well. We also oversee a variety of other types of financially oriented entities, such as consumer finance companies, mortgage lenders, pawnbrokers, pre-need funeral trusts, money transmitters. We have a couple of regulatory agencies, which are regulatory areas, which are really not used, and we have legislation which we are proposing to eliminate. One of them is registration of electronic signature companies. That's not something which we feel is necessary at a statewide level, and in fact, it's not used at a statewide level. And another is registration of international trade consultants. So you will see legislation on both of those. Our goal in this area is generally to ensure that Oregon consumers have access to a wide variety of financial products, but that those financial products are provided in a safe and fair and fraud-free manner. One of the areas that has received quite a bit of attention, and we've spent quite a bit of time looking at during this interim, is that of payday lending. You've probably all seen payday lending storefronts. The growth has been very, very substantial over the past few years here in Oregon. That is an area where we license and regulate. We did a major review of that area and gathered quite a bit of data on how payday loans are used, who uses them, and what the concerns are. There will almost certainly be some legislative proposals coming forward from different stakeholders. We have tightened up our enforcement of existing laws. We have also, and you'll see this in our package, we have increased our consumer education efforts. You will see a brochure which payday lenders are now going to be required to make available to payday lending customers. We have also encouraged credit unions to offer payday loan alternatives, which tend to be at more market-based interest rates rather than the extremely high interest rates which are associated with payday lending. Some of the smaller program areas that we include, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool provides insurance coverage to individuals who cannot obtain coverage in the private market. That may be, for example, if they have a health condition, AIDS or cancer or heart disease, that means that a private insurance company will not provide coverage to them on an individual basis if they have no group coverage alternatives. And this pool also provides coverage to people who are eligible for portability coverage under federal law but don't have other options. This is not a has market-based premiums. That is, individuals who purchase insurance through this pool do have to pay a market-based premium, but because the claims experience for this group due to the medical conditions is higher, the pool is then subsidized by health insurers at large. They pay an assessment to make up the difference. Another small program within our department is the Office of Minority, Women, and Emerging Small Business. That program certifies those businesses for contracting opportunities with public entities under both state and federal law. And the final small program that I want to mention briefly is our Office of Regulatory Streamlining. This is housed in the Department of Consumer and Business Services, but works with business regulatory agencies statewide. The office was set up under Governor Kulongoski's first executive order. The goal of the Regulatory Streamlining Initiative, which is, again, you'll be hearing more about, is to make sure that Oregon is a friendly place for businesses to do business by reducing regulatory burdens and streamlining regulatory processes without compromising underlying standards of protection for consumers, land use, health and safety, and the like. So, again, you'll be hearing more about that from us later. The department as a whole is very actively engaged in regulatory streamlining, and all of our divisions themselves have projects in place to reduce paperwork and reduce regulatory burdens. I believe you are being handed, if I am correct, a summary of some of our activities and accomplishments and areas of interest this year, and again, it's simply more background for you. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have, and of course, I or any of our administrators will be happy to appear in the future to cover any of these issues in more detail.
Thank you, Corey. I've got a couple of questions. Over the last few months, last 6 months to a year, I've had a number of my local building contractors contact me and express their concerns about the cost of their liability insurance. Is this what that market assistant plan you were talking about? Does that deal with that issue?
Mr. Chair, yes, it does, although it is not itself aimed at pricing. But one of the things we found, we held a number of fairly large meetings with the contractor community to address these issues. One of the things we found was that in some circumstances, contractors did not have good information available about their options and were paying more than they needed to because of that lack of information. In other situations, we found that particular contractors were having to devote an extraordinary degree of time and difficulty to actually finding someone who would offer them coverage. So the market assistance plan can assist in those areas. It can match people up. But there's no question that that is still a very challenging market. We have seen significant price increases, and we have also seen carriers leave the Oregon market. So there's no question that that remains a challenge. But, yes, that is the area that our market assistance plan addresses.
Do you know, is that an issue outside of Oregon also, with builders having difficulty getting the insurance and at any price?
Mr. Chair, yes, it is. And there are some specific parts of the industry that are feeling it. And it tends to be multifamily housing and, to some extent, residential housing in general. And nationally, there have been a series of lawsuits arising out of some specific building products, artificial stucco products in particular. There have not been major issues here in Oregon, but the industry tends to react on a national basis. So contractors who have used some of these products in the past are finding it very challenging to get insurance, and some of the litigation climate is simply a national climate.
Okay, thank you. Is there any other questions,
Mr. Chair? Just to follow up on the same issue, I have contractors talking to me that not only is it difficult to get the insurance, but then there's riders and exceptions. They won't cover certain things in their business climate. Do you do any work on that area?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, you're absolutely right. And in the insurance world, there are, I guess you could divide insurance policies into two categories, the admitted carriers and what are called surplus lines carriers. And the admitted carriers, which are your homeowners and your auto insurance and commercial general liability and most of the insurance that you would deal with on a normal basis, we actually have regulatory authority over what those policies can and can't include and exclude. However, the surplus lines market can do business in Oregon whenever the admitted market is not fully meeting the needs. And the surplus lines market does not have that type of oversight and really often does offer policies which are challenging for a number of people. And in this area in particular, we've certainly heard that a number of the policies exclude more than they include. But the insurance carriers are being very cautious about what they are willing to cover and what they are not. So, yes, we have been looking at that area. We have been working with potential carriers to see whether we can induce new entrants into the market to provide better coverage. We've been working with the Construction Contractors Board as well. But I have heard those same comments, and it is a difficult area. That when you hear someone talk about Lloyd's of London, for example, or some of the other non-standard, those tend to be surplus lines. And in this market, it's mostly surplus lines.
Any other questions, Corey? Thank you very much, Corey.
Thank you.
Let's see. Next up is Mark Long with the Building Codes Division. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Long, always difficult to go after the boss, but I'll do my best to keep up the spirit of DCBS.
It's better than going before. You might.
Yeah, I know. Neither one's good, but we'll do the best we can this morning. Good to see everybody again. I'm going to talk a little bit about building codes. We're passing out a flyer. And what I'd like to do is just start off real quickly, tell you what we do, some of the things we worked on this interim, talk about our regulatory streamlining, some of the new innovative programs we put in, our customer service, and what we see for this next session. So to start off, Building Codes Division is a division within the Department of Consumer and Businesses, as Director Streisinger mentioned. What we do is we adopt statewide building codes. And I know that doesn't necessarily mean much, but that is the building, electrical, plumbing, boiler, elevator, manufactured housing, recreational vehicle, amusement rides. I've probably left somebody out. But we adopt all the codes related to construction in Oregon. And the main purpose of our organization is to adopt a code that is consistently used in all of the 130 different jurisdictions that provide building code services around the state. It's a unique system. There are one of only a couple states in the whole nation that have what's called a statewide building code, where the state adopts it, and again, no matter if we adopt a standard, it's the same standard in Portland or Medford or Eugene, Eastern Oregon, wherever around the state, it's the same code. Many places, cities will adopt a different code, they'll adopt different ordinances. In Oregon, back in 1973, you all said that's not a good idea, and the legislature did and said that we need to have a statewide code. The other thing that we do, and I'm just kind of walking down my fact sheet here, we provide education and consultative services. I'm going to talk a little bit about that later on when I talk about some of the customer service things that we're doing. We license and certify tradespersons in the industry. What that means is if you're an electrician or a plumber or a boilermaker, some of the folks in manufactured housing, elevator worker, we license those workers ourselves. Those are called trades licenses. There's about 42,000 people in the state of Oregon that are licensed by Building Codes Division. So we set those standards. We license individuals to do that work. We also certify all the building inspectors. So there's roughly 1,000 building inspectors out there in state and local jurisdictions. And we set the standards and training requirements for those individuals as well. We also have, if you kind of read down along with me, we provide enforcement actions. We have a compliance section where if you've failed to take out a permit or working without a license or doing something that's kind of outside the scope of your inspector requirements, we have an opportunity to take a look at that and take necessary enforcement actions if necessary. Some of the things that I just kind of wanted to point out about construction in Oregon that's really not specifically related to our division, and you can see it in my document, I think it's kind of interesting. There's $100 million of permit money spent in Oregon on an annual basis by contractors, developers, business owners, homeowners, and this is just for building permits. This is not system development charges. This is not planning and zoning or environmental review. This is simply building permits, plan reviews, electrical permits, mechanical permits. Somebody puts in a wood stove, those kinds of things. Adds up to $100 million. So there's actually quite an impact just from a regulatory standpoint in the state of Oregon. And some of the statistics that I see from Portland State University, the net impact or the overall impact of construction in Oregon is around $5 billion. So having consistent standards, having good training standards, good interpretations really impacts a lot of the economic engine of this state. And we feel that we can play either a very proactive role in that or a very reactive role in that depending upon our leadership. There's 130, as I mentioned earlier, 130 building departments in the state of Oregon carrying out bits and pieces of the inspection programs. It's kind of a patchwork quilt, and I'll talk about our relationship with that when I get off of this page. And then another thing that's interesting for the Building Codes Division is we have 7 advisory boards that help us set all these standards and codes that I talked to you about. So these boards are primarily appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. They work with us on a monthly, quarterly basis to carry out enforcement actions, adopt codes, adopt rules, look at fees. And it's really kind of a unique system for our organization. And frankly, I believe it helps us remain a little bit more customer-focused and customer-involved in what the customer's doing. Because I'm in front of a board or a group like this probably once every 2 weeks talking about what we're doing, making sure that we're providing good service, and making sure the regulations make sense for Oregon. One of the things that's been a change in Oregon over the years, and this is really the map that I have on my second page, is back in 1973 when we were created, we covered most of the state. We were actually the building department. We were the direct service provider. And that has changed over the years, and it really changed significantly in the 1990s, where we went from 70 or 80 different jurisdictions to the 130 now. So I provide services in areas where cities and counties choose not to. So you can see where I provide bits and pieces of the inspection program. This has been a challenge for the state of Oregon, for my department, for the customers we serve, because you can see I have Lake County, I think areas of your district, but I think I only provide electrical inspection down there. The building and plumbing and mechanical are done by the local community. And then as you get up into Northeast Oregon, I provide all those services. And then Southwest Oregon, I have bits and pieces. And this has become, as I said earlier, very challenging, very confusing kind of patchwork quilt of inspection services around the state. And we've continued to try to figure out a way to address this issue and make sure that all of the jurisdictions, including the state, are providing consistent services. And I just think this is important because as you talk about building codes and our either financial picture or operational picture, it's really dependent upon what happens in these rural areas, which are quite subject to feast and famine when it comes to construction, frankly. So I think that's just something I wanted to share with you. The next piece that I shared with you is I talked about our boards. We're a stakeholder-driven organization. We work with a variety of folks that are here in the room today and some that aren't. And I provided you a list of the key stakeholders that we work with. There's roughly 18 groups that not only with our 7 advisory boards work with us to set policy and try to address some of the issues in building codes construction. And what we created last session, and we think it was quite successful in looking at some of the regulatory streamlining bills that were passed last session, is we developed a group called the Construction Industry Policy Advisory Committee. It's made up of these stakeholders. I just wanted you to be able to see some of the folks we work with who will be talking to you probably about building codes issues. And we meet on a quarterly basis through the interim and then on a monthly basis during the session, and as it gets going, probably weekly, and if not a couple times a week as things come up. We try to take these issues that are sometimes quite technical and quite unique just to our organization, get everybody together, whether it's local government, whether it's the trades, whether it's builders, whoever it is, and talk about the issue so that we're in front of you or other groups. Hopefully you get something that you know has consensus of the folks that impact. And one thing that I'll provide to the committee, and I've offered this to the chair as well, if you need help, if there's it's quite often in our system that you might have a couple folks telling you a couple different versions of the same story in the construction field. If you need help, we can take these issues to the Construction Industry Policy Advisory Committee. I'd be happy to try to help facilitate and let you know who's on board, who isn't, and what some of the issues are. We also take our legislation and many of our issues to this group to kind of get a vetting before it comes here as well. So I thought that might be interesting to you. Over the last couple of years, we've heard from our stakeholders, we've heard from you, we've heard from a lot of the folks that I talk to that, frankly, results matter. And I'm going to talk to you about some of the results that we've achieved and that we're in the process of achieving either last interim or that we're working on here in the future. And I got kind of an interesting story to tell you. I was in front of a committee a couple of weeks ago talking about a particular electrical issue, and one of the legislators had watched building codes for many years, said, you know, Building Codes Division is a pocket watch organization designed to regulate pocket watches, and we don't have pocket watches in the state of Oregon anymore. And to a certain extent, he's true. And to a certain extent, we're trying to change that here at Building Codes. I'm going to talk to you about that. And what that means is, for many years, we were the service provider. We focused on inspection. We did most of the inspections in the state of Oregon, so we set up inspection shops. As that's changed, we're really trying to focus on statewide consistency and making sure that if you have constituents or there are folks around the state that have problems, that we're in a position to resolve disputes, interpret codes in a proactive way, and to adopt standards that make sense, and then make sure we have adequate trained and licensed folks. So we are trying to change that pocket watch type of organization and really think about what we want to be in the future, because things are changing quite rapidly in the construction field, and I think that the division needs to change along with that. So the first thing is regulatory streamlining. Last year, we worked to pass a bill, House Bill 2717, that looked at industrial electrical equipment in the high-tech field. Give you a quick background on this. Before we passed the piece of legislation and worked on the rules, we were regulating a piece of equipment, million-dollar piece of equipment coming in from overseas that did things, quite frankly, that none of us understand, but that were by all measures safe and provided important products for the state of Oregon, important industry. High-tech industry came to us and said, look, this regulation just doesn't make sense. You're treating our million-dollar pieces of equipment the same as you treat a toaster or any other electrical product that's sold in the stores. Why are we having the same set of standards for a toaster than we do for this complex equipment? So we did something, and it's important to me. We changed the regulation. Instead of the old system was that all pieces of equipment had to be regulated, and if we found something that was safe, we could exempt it from regulation. We said, let's turn that around. We'll exempt all these high-tech pieces of equipment. If we find something that's unsafe, let's regulate it. So you see, that's kind of a different mindset from a regulatory standpoint, and we think that's important. We're very proud of that success, and we've adopted those rules and are working with not only the high-tech community, but printing, manufacturing, and other kinds of things on these types of equipment. One of the things that I'm doing this interim is changing the 30-year history of how we certify inspectors in the state of Oregon. The old system, frankly, was based on a barrier to entry, where we put in all kinds of standards, and we really limited the inspector pool, and we didn't have a lot of accountability over our inspectors, and we didn't have a lot of proactive training to promote consistency. We are going to be adopting rules at the 1st of February. We've been working on this for a year and a half with local government to change that system so that everything we do related to inspectors is about consistency, about making sure they understand what the standards are, and something very small, but it means a lot to me. That is, if an inspector writes up a correction, that he has to provide the code citation to the customer. Believe it or not, that's not required in the state right now. That's a sounds like a very simple thing, providing somebody what the code is that you're requiring them to make the change on, but that's something we've been trying to get in since 1999, and we finally got it done this last interim. And I think that's huge to develop consistency and hold people accountable to the statewide code that we have. The other thing that we did along regulatory streamlining is we consolidated license types. Before last year, if you were a contractor and you had a plumbing license and a mechanical license and a boiler license and electrical license, we gave you four different pieces of paper. You renewed on different dates. You had four different cards. It was all over the place, and we were able to merge those together. So you got one license from us with one renewal date, one piece of paper, one document to track from the state. I know that sounds simple, but that means a lot to the people, the businesses that we serve. We've also implemented ePay, or will be here shortly, ePay for licensed folks, where they can come in, go online, renew for their license, pay with their credit card if they want to, and be ready to go. Some of the things that we're going to be talking to you, I hope, about for regulatory streamlining, our agenda for this year, if you will, is more licensing streamlining. Right now in the current system, whether you're a boiler contractor or a plumbing contractor, again, the standards, how we how we take in your application, how we take your money, how we provide for renewals, all different. We want to get that consistent. That's House Bill 2181, and we'll be talking to you about that later. In the elevator program, we have a bill to prioritize inspections in that area so that right now, every year, we go out and we look at every single elevator, and we think there's a difference between an elevator that moves 10 inches versus 10 story, and maybe we want to look at that differently, and we're going to talk to you about that. And then we have a bill in to address new technology. One of my largest concerns that I have at building codes is, as I hope the economy grows and we're able to bring businesses in here, if we don't have regulations that meet the needs of either new high-tech or new solar kinds of technology or wind or any other kinds of the biotech that's going on, we need to make sure our regulations can meet the needs of industries, and we'll be talking to you about that as well so that we can be a little bit more proactive. A couple more things I want to point out, and then I'll be happy to take your questions. One of the other things that you've asked us to do is to think differently about state services. In this last interim, we did that. We implemented a couple public-private partnerships. One of them we're very proud of. It's called Permits Protect. It's actually a website where we leverage dollars. We work with the construction industry to collect advertising dollars. Everybody pitched in, whether it was $500 or $1,000, and together we got $10,000 to $15,000. And we run ad campaigns to talk about the importance of taking out permits, when you need a permit, when you don't. We provide information to the consumer. So what I'm trying to get across is we're trying to think outside the box and realize the state can't do it all, and we need to partner with our industries. And if you leverage the resources that are out there, even if it's just a couple $100 contribution, it adds up when you look at 18 different stakeholder groups. And we're able to do that, and hopefully you've either heard or seen some of our television and radio ads talking about the importance of permits. One of the other public-private partnerships is we're working on an enforcement program. Right now it's with our electricians in the Mid-Willamette Valley area. We pitched together with the electrical industry, realizing the state can't do it all, and we've developed a partnership where they help fund a compliance officer that's available on the weekends or after hours to look at work that's being done unlicensed and unregulated, and to help us with that. And we think that's kind of an innovative, different way of looking at enforcement on a statewide basis. And when I get done here, I'll be talking to a group of plumbing businesses about making the same type of pilot available in the Portland area here in the future. One of the last things I want to talk to you, and then I'll be happy to take your questions, is the governor, through his Office of Regulatory Streamline, has made it very clear that customer service is very important for regulatory agencies to understand and to provide. And there's a couple things that we're doing. Last session, Senate Bill 715 was passed, and it really provides a relief valve for large projects coming in the state, industrial type of projects, manufacturing kinds of projects. Provides a relief valve and allows the state of Oregon, whether we're trying to provide economic development assistance or shovel-ready lands or any other type of state assistance, that the state can guarantee to an entity that Building Codes Division, my organization, will be there as a relief valve if the local jurisdiction is either unable or unwilling or doesn't have the resources to get the job done. And we think that's important. And in concert with that, it provided some ability for us to go out and provide consultative services. I just worked with a company over in Northeast Oregon that was looking at leaving the state because of challenges they had getting local plan reviews through. We made a commitment that we'd actually go to their factory and do it in their building with their architect at the time they were developing the plans. That company is going to stay in Oregon, and it's 40 jobs in Northeast Oregon. I know that's not a lot, but it's important to the community of Milton Freewater. And those are the kinds of things that we're trying to do at the state of Oregon to kind of change that pocket watch mentality to service of the future. The last thing that I wanted to share with you, and it's in my packet, and I really look at this, some people call it a regulatory streamlining effort. I look at it as a customer service effort. That's this chart on the back page. This is one of the efforts that I'm most proud of. This is our one-stop electronic permitting pilot that we're working on in the Portland area. And what it's going to allow us to do, it goes fully into effect in April. What it will allow is for the participating jurisdictions listed here. This is a pilot. We work with local government. It's going to allow a contractor or an owner to apply, pay, and receive permits online through a state portal and get their authorization to work instantly for certain types of over-the-counter types of permits. We're going to take out the unnecessary delays of driving down to a local building office and waiting in line to essentially give somebody money and fill out an application. You're going to come in. We'll be able to, you'll be able to type in your address. We'll actually be able to tell you where your project is. That was the most challenging part. Allow you to select the type of permits that you want to have and pay for those with your Visa card online. Parts of the system are up and running now, the address locator and the ability to buy some statewide minor types of permits anywhere in the state of Oregon are available to all jurisdictions and to all customers. That's the statewide piece. But up in the metro area, we're going to get this going. It's happening. And I think that this piece is probably one of the best things we can do to help our customers get through the system quickly, timely, and consistently. So with that, I'll kind of let you ask me any questions if there are any. I provided my business card to you all. Don't hesitate to call me. Whether or not we have the ability to solve problems out there, I'm willing to go to the local area to sit down with businesses, sit down with contractors, and figure out if we can help and make sure that folks know, as far as building codes are in the state of Oregon, we are changing that pocket watch mentality. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to take any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mark. I think we'll start on this side here, Representative Escobar.
I have a couple questions come to mind here. First of all, in the building permit process, when an individual submits their plans, of course, you redline them and then send them back. So what you're telling me is that when these are submitted and they're redlined, they have to be accompanied by the statute or the ordinance that covers that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar, on July 1st, they will have to be.
Okay, so that means that local municipalities...
For building
codes. Because I'm telling you right now, you know, in Jackson County, you go to, doesn't matter what city you go to, it's different.
I've heard that.
Yep, that's fact. Yeah. So this will circumvent that and help stabilize this, because I think you should be able to go to Lakeview, you should be able to go to Portland, you should be able to go to Medford or Ontario and have the same criteria. I don't think that... But that's just my opinion. So this will prevent that, and I applaud that, because that's a good step. The other thing that I'd like to ask, in fact, there's four others. One is on your inspection of these areas that do not have inspectors. You look at your map here, and I assume it's the dark sections. How many people do you have on staff, and what do you charge the particular entities to do the inspections?
Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar, I serve the areas that are shaded.
Correct.
Okay. And I have that provide these services. I have roughly 50 staff members that are located around the state. We have offices in Northeast Oregon, Southwest Coast, on the Mid-Columbia River, and then we use contract offices. We sell permits and take in plans just like you described with Jackson County or anything like that. We operate a building department just like everybody else, and our permit fee rates are set by the legislature and set by the division. They're affirmed by the legislature. And I can't tell you, you know, it depends on the project, but I can tell you whenever we do a survey, because if you think about it from just my perspective, I understand there's a statewide perspective, but as I'm continued to ask to serve less and less of the populated areas, my costs go up to provide those services, but yet my fee rates when I do comparative surveys are on the bottom tier of fee rates for all of Oregon. We have the lowest fee rates in Northeast Oregon, because the city of Pendleton has a program, but we provide Umatilla County as an example. So I can't tell you specifically, but I can tell you on the lower end of the scale, because I track this, and if I need to adjust my fees, I go through a process that ends me back at the legislature, where the legislature reviews that as well. So I hope I answered your question.
Have you ever pursued in looking into doing contractual agreements, example over here in Eastern Oregon with Union and Baker and Harney, as well as Deschutes and Jefferson, to cover that particular area, and then in the southwest part, Jackson, Josephine, and Lane, to cover the three down there, and Lake could do something, I'm sure, with Klamath. So they would be charged accordingly, and yet we wouldn't have 50-some people out here because they're already in place.
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, we've looked at that again. I hate to belabor the issue. Because these areas are typically less profitable to operate, it's difficult to talk to cities or counties about working with us or private contractors to work with us. Those entities are working in the metropolitan areas where there's a density. Our inspectors average 3,000 to 5,000 miles of driving windshield miles per year. There are some, I don't want to get into too complex in our fees, but we also receive some assistance on a statewide basis to offset the fact that we are unable to operate a break-even or profitable inspection services. So there are some things called surcharges that help us offset those costs. And we've looked at working with folks, whether it be through intergovernmental agreement, looking at contracts. There are private entities out there that provide services, many are actually down in your area. But they haven't been interested in helping us in our area, and I suspect it has to do with the large volume, large windshield time, and low permit rates.
Okay, thank you. The other
follow-up.
Not follow-up, but I have a couple more questions here. I have written quite a bit. Sorry here. Okay, online you're talking about permits, which is great, but what kind of permits are you talking about? Because you'd have to submit, if you're doing a building, you'd have to submit drawings of this building, which you cannot do online. Are you talking about like fence permits? But even in Medford, you have to do a drawing of that.
You're kidding.
No.
Excuse me.
That's why I said it's different.
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, these are for what we call over-the-counter permits, and there are all kinds of permits in the construction field, whether it be in electrical, mechanical, and plumbing, and structural, where you don't have to or shouldn't have to submit plans to get those permits, and it's those types of permits. So if you were going to go, and I'm just making this up, I'm not a technician, but if you were to install a water heater, possibly, stakeholders in the audience say, no, he's wrong, but let's just go with that. A water heater. You need to get a permit for that. I hope that doesn't require a plan review. You'd be able to buy that online. Many of the service and repair work kinds of things, we hopefully don't require a plan review. We've identified them, and I'm not specifically clear on exactly which ones. You'd be able to go online and buy these, because those are the types of projects where customer has a problem, they need to do something right away, you get a phone call as a contractor. You really put contractors in a choice of trying to meet the customer's needs or going around the process of getting a permit. It puts them in a terrible position. So this is going to make it easier for people to get those permits, take care of their customers, and be able to operate. Eventually, my vision, I'm going to need help with this, my vision is to allow for plan review to be submitted online to make this whole process paperless and seamless in real time. The technology's there. We just don't have the resources to do it and the infrastructure to work with local governments. I can't tell you, we spent a year just figuring out in the metro area, and I know this sounds like a very simple thing, but we spent a year just figuring out how to get the right address when you're in some parts of Clackamas County, Washington County, other areas. You're not sure if you're in Wilsonville or if you're in Washington County or if you're in Clackamas County. Just getting the right address into a database so contractors know where they're working is huge, because we've heard stories where they think they're in Washington County and they're not. They buy the permit in the wrong place and then they get fined by the one jurisdiction and won't get a refund from another. This is going to solve a lot of those problems, at least up in the metro area. So hope I answered your question. Technology's there. It's about a $10 to $15 million commitment to get it going, though, for the rest of the project. And my budget's $30 million on a two-year basis. I don't have 10
you
to 15.
You don't want to spend half that?
I don't have 10 to 15 to scratch out of that. You know, $150,000 to get this thing going, you bet. But 10 to 15, I'm not there yet.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. And if you had the 10 to 15 million, how long would it take you to get there? And what percentage of the state would be able to receive and send back and forth?
Mr. Chair, Representative Representative Schaffler. Probably take us 3 to 5 years. You know, it's really tough for bureaucrats to sit up here and commit on IT projects. That's pretty dangerous ground. But we've actually been successful this last year with our commitments on IT projects, thanks to the help we're getting from the department. But our best analysis at this point is 3 to 5 years. Again, the technology's there, okay? It's developing the local and state relationships that take a little while, okay? And it's also and it's getting the software put together. So, again, and getting the resources identified.
The visibility bill for the wheelchairs going in, or just one elevation from the street all the way through the room and the doors, where's that at as far as designing buildings?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, you know, I think that bill was put into a different agency than mine, and so I think that has to do when you, and I'm guessing here, but I think that if there are federal public dollars, then that's part of the design through the housing agency approval and whatnot. It isn't part of the building codes regulation.
And then just one more, and you'll have to forgive me, Mr. Chair, as we modernize the pocket watch analogy, you know, my grandpa, I remember when he got his first flush toilet in his dairy farmhouse in Minnesota, and he was really proud of that. And I remember going out to the two-holer before that. And so as we modernize, I don't want to replace a pocket watch with a waterless urinal, because we've already done that once. This little editorial there.
I hear you.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
That's good.
Mr. Long, I'm got a question. I'm curious, does the building codes division in licensing or providing the service of building inspection, and then the building inspection services and the local building inspection agencies, do they have any liability for ensuring compliance to the codes and the licensing on properly permitted projects?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, as far as specific liability, you know, that would be in a legal context, you know, I'm not sure how that works. They have accountability to us with these new standards that I'm talking to you about. If you suggest that the state standard is a mini-maxi where you can't go below the standard or above the standard, which is true here in Oregon, we've now made it clear with if you're going to write a correction, if you're going to cite a correction, you have to meet that state standard, and you have to follow that, and if you're not willing or able to do that, you're going to be subject to action by our department. Now, that skeleton is new. We haven't put all the meat on the bone, so to speak, so I can't tell you that we've necessarily taken action or we have an infrastructure in place that would accomplish that, but we're really changing the thinking at building codes to go from many of the requirements were placed on a jurisdiction to make sure these things occurred, and frankly it's difficult to talk to another government entity about particular problems of staff changes and whatnot. So we've turned this around with these new sets of rules and made the individuals responsible for the state code and the inspectors to us, so that if they are wandering outside of this minimum maximum, we receive a complaint, we find out about it, we look at it, we have some actions that we can take, from, you know, requiring training to suspension to revocation. So I hope I answered your question. And it's new. This is brand new. It's going to happen February 1st.
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to ask this is my concern is also for the consumer in this department, where the project has been signed off by an inspector as being in compliance, and some time later we find horrific problems that the code actually wasn't met, and then we get into legal battles of who's going to pay for the bringing the project back into compliance, and oftentimes the consumer is the one that is left holding the bag, and that kind of concerns me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holy, I understand that, many of those issues are resolved through the Construction Contractors Board, through Craig Smith's system. But also, I'll just add that Oregon's system is when it comes to these kinds of things, is a three-legged stool, where we have licensed architects and engineers, designers, we have licensed workers that do the work, and then we have better standards now for the inspectors. It all has to work together. And as far as individuals' liability and how that all works out, typically that ends up in the court system, as you so indicated. So, but again, I'm willing, and I've been involved in a particular case down in your area over the last couple of years trying to help with particular projects, but at some point it just gets into the legal system and outside of our purview.
Any other questions, Mark? Thank you, sir, for being here this morning.
Yeah.
We'll probably be seeing a lot of you over the next few months. All right, moving on, we'll get an overview from the Employment Department as Director Debbie Lincoln, please. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you here this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to be here. I appreciate it. For the record, my name is Debbie Lincoln. I'm the director of the Oregon Employment Department, and I have with me today Tom Byerly, the assistant director for unemployment insurance programs. He knows the details and can answer all your questions. I think we have a handout being passed out, so I'll wait until you get that. There's quite a bit of detail in this handout, and I'll just hit the very high points, but of course welcome your questions on anything that comes up as you look through it. We are concentrating in this presentation on unemployment insurance because that's what I understand you wanted to hear about, but I want to emphasize that we have several other programs. We are the Employment Department, not the Unemployment Division, and we stress that our job is helping people become employed. And our mission, which you see on page one, speaks to that. Our mission is very simply that we support business and promote employment. Business is our primary customer. Without businesses, we don't have jobs to put people into. So we take that very, very seriously. We have several programs that support that mission very obviously. First of all, we're an insurance company. We insure three things. We insure communities, we insure individuals, and we insure a workforce. When somebody becomes unemployed, as you know, the community in that person lives in, or if there's a large layoff in a particular community, not only the individuals suffer, but also the grocery stores, the gas stations, the taxi companies, all the other services around it. So unemployment insurance is there very much to support communities through periods of downturn so they can stay on their feet, stay viable until the economy bounces back. And of course, we insure individuals who have had some work history so that they have a safety net and can survive a downturn until they either get another job or get called back to their previous employer. And we insure the workforce in an area. That is, we ensure that a workforce is able to be maintained in an area, doesn't move out, so that when the economy comes back, that workforce is available to go back to work and help the economy grow again. Our second program, our second contribution to that support business and promote employment mission is our business employment services. We serve businesses by recruiting and referring well-qualified, job-ready workers to fill their workforce needs. We provide resources to a whole bunch of job seekers, especially UI claimants. The original purpose of the program back in the early 30s was to get UI claimants back to work, to get into the workforce and to move up the career ladder once they're there. So we serve with job search services, not only those folks who are unemployed, but also those people who have a job but want to move up and want to look at new jobs. And we serve everybody, all takers. We universal access is a very big part of our efforts. Our third program is workforce and economic research. A lot of the information that you see about the economy, the unemployment rate, for example, that came out yesterday, our folks do that. We do research on all sorts of labor market, economic, workforce kinds of issues that are of value to a whole bunch of constituencies, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. The fourth element of our mission is our child care division services. The question why child care here is in the employment department is always the first thing that comes to most people's mind. And that reason, the answer to that is that child care is essential for a productive workforce. If you were to look at all your employees who do not, who have children, and all the child care people go on strike one day, you're not going to have those people showing up for work. So a productive, active workforce and success of businesses is a interest of ours, and child care is very, very important to that, so that we provide those services, ensure quality and quality and accessible child care. If you'll turn to the next page, our org chart is there. I want to emphasize a couple of the other things that we do. In addition to the four programs I just mentioned, we host the Office of Administrative Hearings. This is the central hearing panel that does administrative hearings for most state agencies. Serves about 70 agencies, provides hearings officer services. About half of their responsibility is unemployment insurance hearings. They also do transportation hearings and a number of the other smaller, more regulatory hearings. Building codes, for example, hearings are done by the Office of Administrative Hearings. That section does report to me. We also host the Employment Appeals Board, which doesn't report to me. That's a board of three people appointed by the governor who are the higher level appeals authority for unemployment insurance appeals. They are the ones that people go to after they've gone through the hearings panel if they have an issue with unemployment insurance or with their employment taxes. We have a number of advisory bodies. The Child Care Commission is staffed by the Child Care Division. That's a commission of folks appointed by both the governor and the legislature to take a look at specifically at child care issues. And by the way, I sit on the Commission for Children and Families to make that connection between child care and the Commission for Children and Families. We also have Oregon Employer Councils all around the state. This is a very interesting organization. Each of our main field offices has an Oregon Employer Council connected to it, and the purpose of this is to give us grassroots advice and connections to our community so that we remain very, very community-oriented. It's a group of businesses that come together very voluntarily, it's very fluid membership, to advise the employment department and to bring low-cost seminars and education to their local communities, their business communities. They are a separate nonprofit agency. We don't control them, but we do staff them, and we take their advice and suggestions and input very, very seriously. It's very important to us. We also work with the Federal Veterans Education and Training Group, and we have a big veterans effort in our department, employment of veterans, and we're doing quite a few things right now as we're anticipating veterans coming back from the Middle East. And then our main advisory group is the Employment Advisory Committee, which is the membership of that is listed on the next page, page 3. It's an advisory committee similar to MLAC that Corey talked about earlier, but made up of management, labor, and public members. It's appointed by the governor but is not confirmed by the Senate. This committee advises us on statewide issues, especially around unemployment insurance programs and funding, taxes, and legislation. In addition to the Employment Advisory Committee, we're also very much connected to the Oregon Workforce Information Board. I sit on that as the head of the department, and we get involved in workforce issues, and we are part of the WorkSource Oregon system through that board. The next thing I want to talk about a little bit on pages 4 and 5 is what we have been doing in the last 2.5 years to change the way we do business. Not long after I came to the department, I found we were in a very, very high period of unemployment. Our workload was high. It was the worst part of this last recession. And we started looking at how we were doing business and looking ahead at ways to make what we're doing a lot more customer service oriented and much more efficient and much more consistent, and with an idea that if ever the workload gets that high again, we'll be prepared for it. We'd be a little more proactive. Several things happened at that time that forced us into or gave us the opportunity to look at how we do business and make major changes. Governor Kulongoski came on board and hit the ground running with an emphasis on economic development and the important role of workforce development in that. And as a major player in the workforce system, we took that as a green light to get very much involved and really kick off our services to business and the workforce. The second thing that was happening at the time and actually is still happening is the reauthorization of the Workforce Investment Act by Congress. That's an act that was passed in 1998. It drives it a lot of what we do in services to business and job seekers and our participation in the workforce program. And it was up for reauthorization. It was not reauthorized. It looks like it might be on a fast track with Congress right now, but the Bush administration has proposed a number of changes in that which may affect the way we provide employment services and labor exchange and work with our partners. So that's something else that we needed to address. Diminishing revenues, we aren't in the kind of a situation that the general fund agencies are in, but federal revenues have, and this says beginning in 2005, have begun to diminish. That's not true. They've been diminishing for a number of years. States all over the country have been underfunded for both employment services and unemployment insurance administration for a number of years, and we needed to start planning for that before we were in crisis mode. Another thing that has been very, very exciting for us is that technological advances have gotten us to the point where they're available to address much of the process-oriented activities that we have, particularly in unemployment insurance. The technology, we let other states develop and prove it and make the mistakes, and then we've taken on a lot of what they've done a lot ourselves, but we jumped right in with a lot of technological improvements. And we were able to do that because we had some one-time federal money that had a time frame on it. We would lose if we didn't use it, that we could invest in some of these technological improvements and come up with efficiencies that would save us money and time and improve customer service in the future. So we've taken advantage of that. And as with most state agencies, we're looking at a big chunk of folks retiring in the next few years. We've got about 25% of our workforce, and we have between 1,400 and 1,500 people at any one time eligible for retirement, taking a huge wealth of information and knowledge about a very complex program with them. So we had to do something in order to address all these issues. We started with the premise that if we got UI out of our local field offices and provided unemployment insurance services in a more efficient, consistent way, we could then focus our field office efforts on serving businesses and getting people back to work. So that's what we did. We looked at how other states are doing UI call centers or service centers and went that route, and Tom is really the brains behind this. What we've done is eliminated the paper shuffle between claimants and the department in favor of person-to-person interaction over the telephone and the internet. We provided high quality and consistent staff training so that claimants and businesses get consistent answers and consistent application of policy across the state. As you mentioned, Representative Esquivel, and with the building codes, every city does it a little bit differently. With UI scattered across our 47 field offices, it was just very, very difficult to get consistent and ongoing answers from all our staff, keep them trained, keep them up to date on the changes in the law and so forth. And by concentrating our folks into three UI centers, we've been able to do that. And we provided UI services. We will, as soon as we're completely in place, with about 100 fewer staff. And we've done that by creating three UI centers, one in Eugene, one in the Portland metro area, and one which will open in April in Bend. Brought all our UI staff in from field offices, located them in those facilities, and put them on the telephone and the internet, and almost entirely eliminated paper claims. We've done this on time, under budget. We came in about $400,000 under the budget that we told you last year we were going to be using. And again, with about 100 fewer FTE, and the response from claimants is just overwhelmingly positive. They get their claim filed, their basic issues taken care of right away over the telephone without having to do the paper shuffle, the back and forth telephone tag, and so forth. That could sometimes make 2 or 3 weeks to get a claim filed. So it's been very, very successful. This then, as I mentioned, allowed us to focus our services in our field offices on business and applicants for jobs. We feel that the Employment Department's presence in local communities, particularly smaller communities, is very, very important. And we don't want to pull that out of any of our communities. So even though UI is not going to be handled out of those offices, we anticipate keeping all of our field offices open and available to serve the communities. And again, the local connection is very important to us. It's very important that our staff know what the local business climate is, what the economic situation is, what the workforce needs are of their communities in order to fully serve the people in those communities. We are moving toward an account representative system where our staff will be experts in specific industries, and a business can get one-on-one, very knowledgeable service in terms of hiring qualified staff. And we have launched a new skills-based, web-based job search system that I think is cutting edge in the country. It's on the internet. It's called iMatch Skills. You can get through our website. Employers can match for workers based on skills rather than on job title, and the matches come up much, much better, and I would be delighted to show this to anybody who's interested. We could demonstrate it. It's something that employers particularly have very much appreciated having available to them. They can manage their own job search from their office over the internet, all the way from self-service to having a staff-assisted service from us, and it's been very successful. Cost-benefit of these changes, as a note on the bottom of page 5, we expect to recover our infrastructure costs in 3 years, and once we are up to speed, we're looking at saving $3.6 million per biennium in administrative costs. We did take advantage of those 100 fewer FTE needed for UI and reinvested nearly 50 of them in business and employment services so that our field offices got those FTE, to improve services to business and job seekers. On the next page, next two pages, we cover the five major programs. I've already talked about business and employment services and unemployment insurance. I want to mention again the Workforce Economic Research Division. These are the folks who bring you the unemployment rate, as well as a whole multitude of labor market information and economic information, and very much about specific communities. We have research staff stationed around the state, so again, they know their communities very well. Who can do economic analyses, workforce analyses, special surveys, special studies, come up with the information that's very, very important for policymakers to have in order to make informed decisions. And our child care division, I mentioned already, you may have seen the article in the Oregonian recently about the teen parent child care center at Roosevelt High School. We funded that. It's one of the kinds of things we do. We manage all the federal money that comes into the state for child care. A lot of it we then transfer over to the Department of Human Services to support the subsidized child care programs for people of low income, but we also use that money to license and certify daycare and home care centers and to support child care resources and referral activities so people can find child care, as well as to help train and provide technical assistance to child care providers so that they are as qualified and trained to handle our most important resource. And then the Office of Administrative Hearings. Again, we manage administrative hearings for over 70 agencies and have been able to, because of the economies of scale, have been able to lower the costs and the time frames for most of those agencies. The next page, we get into unemployment insurance. Just briefly, I'm going to go over some of the high points here, and then if you have any more detailed questions, of course, Tom's has been in the system for 24 years and 20-some years and can answer those questions for you. As you know, it's been around for 70 years. There are actually two taxes that support the system, and I go into more detail later on how this whole funding system works, because I think that's very important. One's a federal tax collected by the federal government. It's administered and controlled by the federal government and by Congress, and that tax is for administration of the UI system. Another one, the second tax then is a state unemployment tax, which is collected, controlled, and administered by you, even though it's invested in the U.S. Treasury, and that tax is specifically for the payment of UI benefits. It funds the UI trust fund. Again, the unemployment insurance program is there to provide economic stability for communities. It's to maintain the skills in the labor force so that we don't lose them in periods of downturn. It's to provide wage replacement benefits for eligible workers, and it's to ensure that those workers are focused on job search and on getting back to work while they are unemployed. Conformity and compliance, because we are a federal program, this is extremely important. Conformity simply means that our laws agree with the federal laws. Compliance means that we are running the programs the way the federal government wants us to run them. If we don't conform and comply to federal rules and requirements, our employers get a big financial hit. There are financial sanctions through the unemployment tax on our employers. So we are very, very careful to ensure that we are in compliance with the federal government. There are several ways of determining somebody's eligibility. Again, this is an insurance program. It's not based on need. So it's not a social services program. You have to have met certain requirements before you can get unemployment insurance. The first is a monetary eligibility, which is a combination of how much you've worked and what kind of wages you've earned over a base year period. Another is what we call non-monetary eligibility, which means simply that if you've left work without good cause or were discharged because of some kind of work-related misconduct, you aren't eligible. You also have to be physically able, available, and actively seeking work while you're on unemployment insurance benefits, or we kick you off benefits. So there are a lot of requirements to meet in order to get that unemployment insurance, and that's what our UI service centers do, is determine eligibility for workers. We pay benefits by the week based on the worker's salaries or salary or wages in that base year, with a minimum and a maximum, and that's calculating that is all set by statute. Our minimum is $93 a week, right? And max is $419. Is that where we are? A characteristic of this last recession is that we had a lot of highly paid workers who were on unemployment, a lot of professionals, a lot of high-tech folks, which meant that they drew the maximum weekly benefit amount, which meant a bigger drawdown on our trust fund than we've seen in previous recessions. And that's one of the things we've been taking into account as we've looked at the solvency of our trust fund. For this last year, though, the average benefit amount was $245, which I think is probably right about where most states are. There are exclusions to unemployment insurance coverage. Not everybody in the state is covered. And there are two ways to get an exclusion. The federal government allows exclusions, and the state may choose to adopt those exclusions. If we do, and those particular occupations are excluded, then the employers of those occupations don't pay either state or federal unemployment tax. And there are some examples on the next page. Domestic workers, for example, newspaper delivery people are excluded. You may be interested to know that you're excluded. Members of a legislative body, publicly elected officials are excluded.
Does that mean we couldn't draw unemployment?
That's right. Sorry. Oh.
We wouldn't qualify from the lower part anyway.
Mr. Chair, I think it's because we're physically unable to work.
Speak for yourself.
That was good. The other category of exclusions are state-only. The state may choose to exclude other occupations that the federal government doesn't exclude, but in that case, the employers of those people don't pay state unemployment tax, but they pay the full non-discounted federal tax. So that gets into such things as golf caddies. We, a few years ago, excluded golf caddies. And so a golf course doesn't pay the state tax, but it does pay the federal tax at the full rate. So that's a really quick overview of the UI system. Need to get into the funding a little bit because it's going to be part of the bills that may come in front of you. We'll need a background of that. As on page 12, we start with that. As I mentioned, there are the two unemployment taxes, the federal unemployment tax collected by the federal government, transferred to the U.S. Treasury, and then sent back to all states for administration of unemployment insurance, labor market information, and some employment services. The other tax is the state unemployment tax, collected, controlled, and administered by the state government, but also invested it by the U.S. Treasury. And that comes back to each individual state as in the form of UI benefits. The federal unemployment tax rate is actually 6.2% on the first $7,000 of wages earned, but the federal government discounts that to 0.8%, and that's the discount that they have as a sanction in case we don't conform and comply. If we were not to conform and comply, the federal government could, instead of charging 0.8%, bump it all the way up to 6.2%, which would be several billion dollars of impact on our employers in terms of tax increase. So again, it's very important that we comply with the federal government's rules and requirements. The state tax account, is controlled by Oregon statutes. It is variable. We recalculate it every year, and it's a range from about, actually the lowest is 0.5%, but the average lowest is 1.5, up to 5.5% on the first so many dollars of payroll this year, and last year it's $27,000 of payroll. And again, that's all part of keeping the trust fund solvent, which we'll talk about in a minute. Page 13, the federal unemployment tax goes into several buckets at the federal level. Again, important in terms of what we can get back from the federal government of the taxes that our employers pay. First of all, it goes into an administration bucket, and that's the bucket that the feds pay all states for administration. And we don't get back what we send to them. No state does. And there's a very detailed formula about what they pay each state out of that bucket. So we keep very close watch on the Department of Labor and how they determine those amounts and the states to get work together to try to ensure that that's a fair and equitable formula. When that bucket is full, additional money then goes into the next budget bucket, which is benefit extensions. Are you aware of all the extensions we had over the last two or three years? Some of those were state-only extensions, which we paid for, but some of them were federal extensions and federal-state extensions. And when the feds pass an extension, that's the money comes out of this bucket to fund those extensions. So that's the second bucket. The third bucket, then, when those two are full, is a bucket of loans. When a state bankrupts its trust fund, goes insolvent, needs money, it can borrow from this bucket called loans, but it has to pay back that money at market rates. So it's not free money, and that bucket continued to turn around. This past year, the big states went insolvent: California, Texas, New York, Illinois, South Carolina, and a few of the smaller states all bankrupted their trust funds and had to borrow either from the feds or on the open market, and simply in order to pay benefits. We did not, because our trust fund it has been set up so well, and I want to talk about that in a few minutes, because we are able to do some things that other states can't. And then when those three buckets are full, it goes into a bucket called the READ Act bucket, and this one's been around for about 50 years. The idea was that when all the other needs were taken care of, then the READ Act bucket would send money back to the states for administration and for their trust funds. There's only been about three or four distributions in those 50 years. They were supposed to happen every year, but it hasn't. So there's a pot of money sitting in that READ Act bucket back at the U.S. Treasury that states have are continually trying to get some money back out of. We did get a READ Act distribution a couple of years ago. We got $98 million, and we are using some of that to backfill some of the shortfall fundings. The bulk of it sits in the trust fund, again, to ensure that we have enough money to pay benefits and we can keep taxes low. So my national organization is trying to get another READ Act distribution to help all states, but particularly those who came up with insolvent trust funds. That's an important piece of our connection with the feds and one of the activities we keep very close track of. On the next page, on page 14, this is what our tax schedules look at like. Again, each state is able to, for the state unemployment trust account, each state is able to develop its own taxing scheme for its trust account, and our state has done a very, very good job in putting that in place and putting it in statute and making it solid. We have eight tax schedules that ensure that the system is forward funded. That is, it's designed to fill up the trust fund in good times, so that we don't have to raise taxes in bad times. If you'll notice, for example, in Tax Schedule 8, which is the highest tax schedule, it ranges from 2.2 to 5.4%, with an average of 3.10%. We were in Schedule 8, the highest tax schedule, all through the 80s, because we were trying to recover from that really bad 1980s recession, where we did become just about insolvent. So we filled it up through the 80s. As the economy got better and better, we were able to continue to drop down, and through the good years of the 1990s, we're in tax schedule 3, because the trust fund was healthy. We had high employment, and there was money going into the trust fund. So again, this is all done by statute. It's not something that administratively I can decide once a year which tax rate we're going to go into, and I'm glad of that. I used to be a DCBS and had to do the workers' comp assessment, and that was administratively done, and I would just as soon it be in statute and you all control it, not me. So it works really well.
Debbie, then that this level is the legislature every 2 years establishes this level, then
no, Mr. Chairman, no. It's in statute now. You don't have to look at it every 2 years.
Automatic.
We just, it's automatically done. If you wanted to change it, and you have changed it before, and we're going to actually propose one change in one part of this in this legislative session, you could change it, but it's worked very well. We don't have to change it. Massachusetts, for example, had to bump up taxes by 75% and cut benefits in half during this recession, during the middle of the worst part of the recession, because they didn't have this kind of self-adjusting, forward-funding tax system, which ensures solvency. On the next page, page 15, this graph is a picture of the tax the state unemployment tax fund over the years, you'll notice on the early part, the 1980s is when we really did dip so low that we had to do some borrowing and fix our statutory tax system in order to ensure that doesn't happen again. And then through the years, particularly through the 90s, the trust fund was very, very healthy. You see the dip through this recent recession, but the projections of it going back up again. The top dotted line is another reason why we are solvent. That is the benchmark that the statute holds us to. We benchmark how much money we need to have in the trust fund in order to ensure that we can pay benefits. Right now, there are two formulas in the statute. The one that we have been using is a formula that says we can pay benefits for 18 months at a particular unemployment rate. And that's stood us in very good stead. We think we can lower that benchmark, as a matter of fact, to a lower unemployment, 18 months at a lower unemployment rate, and still keep the trust fund very, very healthy, very solvent. And that's what I want to talk to you about next, is our House Bill 2127, which is our proposal to change that benchmark and do a couple of other things with the trust fund and with the taxing system that will, I think, put us in a better fiscal position and help the state recover from the economy. House Bill 2127 does three things. It reduces business taxes by 12% over the next 4 years. It gives us a marketing tool to help.
Tamara, could you get some water, please?
Thanks. Marketing tool to help us attract businesses to Oregon, and it helps us to stabilize funding for business services and services to job seekers. The first thing that we're going to do in order to reduce taxes is to change that benchmark we just talked about. We're currently benchmarked at 7.6 insured unemployment rate. That is 18-month recession at 7.6 insured unemployment. Excuse me, 7% insured unemployment rate. That's not the unemployment rate you see in the paper. That's only the unemployment rate of those people covered by unemployment insurance. This past recession, our insured unemployment rate never got over 5.2. This is kind of, I'm seeing some scowls. It's the rate of people who are only covered by unemployment insurance. The one you see in the paper is the unemployment rate for everybody in the state, including all those people who are excluded and who are not claiming unemployment and that kind of thing. So what we want to do is simply lower that benchmark to about 5.6. And that alone will save employers close to $200 million in the next 4 years, because we won't be collecting taxes because we don't need that much money in the trust fund. So that's the first piece of it. The second piece is that we're going to take a look at the new employer base rates. When a new employer opens up, hires its first employee, because this is an insurance program, you need to have an experience rating in order to get your insurance rate. And because they don't have any experience yet, we give them a flat base rate until they get experience, about 12 months. Chart on page 16, you'll see our tax schedules. We're currently in Schedule 5. The current base rate for new employers is in the second column. So this year, our average rate for all employers is 2.5%, but our base rate for new employers is 3.2%. This proposal would smooth out and drop down the new employer base rates so that this year they would be paying 2.9%. And as you get into the lower tax schedules, that drops even more. So it's a fairly significant savings, as much as $17 or $18 million for employers over the next 4 years. And it's also a marketing tool that we can use to bring businesses to Oregon. Last fall, Idaho put out a brochure that said, bring your business to Idaho because our tax, our unemployment tax rates are lower than Oregon's. They didn't bother to point out that their trust fund was on the edge of bankruptcy. But they did use that as a marketing tool, and so we want to counter that as well as to save employers' taxes, of course. The third thing that we want to do is take a look at that taxable wage base. I mentioned that the state tax is assessed on this year the first $27,000 of payroll. We take a look at that taxable wage base every year when we look at what's in the trust fund, what we need to be solvent, which tax schedule we need to be in. We also look at how much taxable wage base. And it's based on an average annual weekly wage. We would figure that out, and then we would round that to the nearest $1,000. Simply by rounding it to the nearest $100 does two things. It saves employers about $10 million over the next 4 years. It also evens out and makes more gentle those incremental increases over the years as that taxable wage base does go up. So that's another important piece. I'm going to wait to talk through the next two pieces of this legislation until I go through some other things, and we'll come back to that. But I want to show you on page 18 what this recession has done to us.
If you adjust it to the nearest, that adjustment you're going to make for House Bill 2127,
mm-hmm.
you make that adjustment to save, and then you I'm asking this question now because I think I have it in my head, and then you raise this actual projected base, even then you would actually been taxing a little more because you're $229 more than you were if you're just $27,000. Even with that adjusted actual base, you still save money because the base is going to go up rather than 27,000. It's going to go up to 27,229. And I see your assistant back there saying, yes, we still save money.
Yes, well,
it
yes.
Well. Do you see what I'm asking?
I see what you
mean. And you still save money.
Save money, yeah.
And keep your funds full.
Exactly.
Okay.
Over the years, adjusting that taxable wage base to $100 rather than $1,000 is kind of a wash over 20 years, because some years it'll go up and some years it'll go down. But in the near future, it is a savings. And again, the smoothing out the increments is important to employers, I think.
Okay, thank you.
Page 18 is a picture of what unemployment insurance has done for each county over this one of the bad years of the recession. It's kind of small. The top number in each county is how much your employers in that county paid into unemployment insurance taxes. The black number is the one that is the amount of benefits you got back. And then your unemployment insurance rate is there. So, Mr. Chairman, in Lincoln County, your employers paid in $4.9 million. They got back $12.45 million in benefits with an 8.6% unemployment rate over the calendar year 2003. So it just gives you an idea of how important unemployment insurance has been over the past couple of years to keep communities alive.
Representative Esquivel.
Well, on this example, you say, according to this information, Jackson County's paid in 25.73 and received 45.7 in return. Is the 25.73 just 1 year?
Yes. Correct.
So that's a little ambiguous, because if they've been paying in for 4 or 5 years, 6 years, 10 years, or whatever, it's an accumulation, is it not?
It is, but they've also, Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar, they've also been getting benefits back in those same times. So we could give you the same information over 5 years or 10 years. And there would be years when probably when unemployment was very low in the middle of the 90s when you paid in more than you got back in terms of benefits. We'd be glad to do that. This is a snapshot, though. So every year you pay in, every year benefits come back to your counties. And some years one's higher and some years one's lower. This is an illustration simply of how UI has helped keep communities solvent through this particular recession. Okay. The next thing I want to talk about is a funding source that we have at the state level that supports services to business and job seekers, as well as labor market information. It's called the Supplemental Employment Department Administrative Fund. Those of you who were here last session may remember it. Some of this was redirected to the general fund last biennium, and it's the only really state-controlled pot of money that we have in the employment department. We do get federal money to support our business employment services called Wagner-Peiser funds. That money has been flat for the last 15 years. No cost of living, no inflation, no covered employment increases. It funds about a third of our business employment services now. Most states who don't have a state fund to support business employment services have very skeletal labor exchange, practically nothing at all. In the early 90s, the business community and the legislature got together and determined that they really wanted to provide those kinds of services to businesses and job seekers, and created a mechanism to do that. What they did was set aside part of employers' SUTA tax into what's called a benefit reserve fund, which is invested in the state treasury, and then the interest off that fund was directed into the Supplemental Employment Department Administrative Fund, or CDAF. The principal in the benefit reserve fund is there only to pay benefits. It can't be used for anything else, but that interest went into CDAF. CDAF is at the point now where it funds two-thirds of our business employment services. It also provides a lot of funding for our labor market information, economic information activities, and supports 71% of our field offices around the state. Again, those vital connections to our communities that keep us serving on a local level. As interest rates fell, of course, the revenue from CDAF also fell. And if you go back to page 17, we address that in House Bill 2127. Our proposal is that we get rid of that benefit reserve fund. There are a couple of reasons why it's not fiscally sound. One is that it's, again, invested by the state treasury, and we don't get the same amount of interest as we do with the federal treasury. So we're losing $1 million or so a year in interest simply by having it in the state treasury rather than federal treasury. So we need to get rid of that benefit reserve fund and have only the SUTA fund. So we're going to spend that down by spending benefits out of it. Another thing that makes it a little unsound is that it's invested in short-term securities. And if we had a crisis in unemployment and had to dip into it and sell it off quickly, we'd lose money. So it's not a very good mechanism for long term. So we are going to start paying UI benefits out of the VRF until it's depleted. And then what we want to do is redirect a certain percentage of the SUTA taxes to CDAF. Rather than taking the interest from the VRF and put it in CDAF, we'd simply redirect some SUTA taxes to CDAF. It's not an assessment on top of taxes, so that employers won't see any difference. They will pay the same whether or not we redirect this money to CDAF or not. The amount is such that it's almost entirely offset by the increased interest earnings from having all this money invested by the federal government, and by our not having to use those one-time READ Act monies that we've been using to backfill, which can then stay in the SUTA. So it's almost within a couple $100,000 of a wash in terms of impact on the fund in the coming biennium. And as time goes on and as that money does what it's supposed to do, which is to help improve the economies of the state, it should be a very, very good investment. Some of the things on...
Thank you. What's the federal government doing with the money to get a better return than we are?
Mr. Chair and Representative Schaffler, I'm afraid I couldn't tell you. I think we are, my understanding is that the Oregon Investment Council is simply more conservative than the federal government, and it may be an economy of scale kind of a thing, too.
Representative Eskel.
Are we not prohibited
I don't know whether it's state statute or what, that we can only receive an 8% return and a limitation on investments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar, that does sound right. Yeah. We'll find out for you and be sure we get that question answered. All I saw was an increase in $1 million in interest and said,
show me the money. Huh?
Yeah.
May I have one more time? I'm sorry.
Certainly, Richard.
Now, is there, obviously, with greater returns, there may well be a greater risk, too. Would you find that out for me, too?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, yes, we will. My feeling is that there's not, because of the size of what's sitting up there. Mm-hmm. That REDAC bucket tends to be the fallback. Mm-hmm. Federal government keeps that to balance the deficit, even though it can't be used for anything else. So if there was a plunge in interest rates at the federal level, well, I don't know how that would work through, but I think it's just the size of it that prevents the risk. But, yeah, we'll do a little analysis on that whole question.
If they're using it to balance the deficit, they must be empty.
They don't. It's an accounting trick.
Okay, thank
they don't
you.
Actually spend Forgive the money to balance the deficit.
Okay.
Well, I've talked quite a bit about what we do for businesses in the job seeker, so I'm not going to go into any detail on that. On what CDAF is for, but I would like to emphasize that's what we think our first responsibility is to serve businesses to get people back to work and to ensure high quality, high paying, family wage jobs for as many people as we can, and that's what that money supports. The next two pages talk about our involvement in the Workforce Investment Act, and again, I don't want to go into any detail on that.
Sure.
Yes, Representative.
I just wanted to ask one thing that Representative Esquivel referred to before you move off of this. You know, the investment sounds you know really good, and saving some of those money sounds really good. But it does make me a little bit nervous talking about reducing the size of this fund in light of the talk of insolvencies in other states, mm-hmm. Specifically Idaho, and it kind of sounds like we're trying to compete with them somewhat by coming closer to insolvency. So I'd really like to see the numbers that Representative Escobar referred to on from going back for at least a five-year period or on the amount of money going in and the amount of money going out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hull, we'd be glad to do that. That's definitely something we'll have in support of 2127. I would like to say we took a very, very careful look with our actuaries on ensuring that fund would stay solvent even with the lower benchmark. And my number one responsibility as director is to ensure the solvency of that fund. Had we been at the lower benchmark through this recession and through the recession in the 90s, we would have been fine, and we could have continued to fund the extended benefits and so forth. If we got into a recession the likes of the early 80s, then all bets are off. This existing system wouldn't work, but nobody expects a recession like that for a variety of reasons. But we have, because labor is as much a partner as management, we have talked with labor groups, and AFL-CIO, for example, has asked that question, is keeping a close watch on whether or not the fund is sufficiently funded under this proposal, and we've got an agreement from everybody that it is. So I'm comfortable that it doesn't put us at any risk to lower that benchmark. But we will get that history of money paid in and money paid back.
Thank you.
Representative Escobar, you have...
Yes, and correct me if I'm wrong, Director Lincoln. Idaho does not fluctuate with their ins and outs like we do. We stay more or less on top of it a year or two down the road with our actuary tables. It was my understanding in Jackson County that that's what we were talking about. The people who are insolvent have not kicked it in gear to replenish that fund.
Oh,
soon enough.
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative Escobar, that's correct. California, for example, never adjusted its taxable wage base. It kept it the $7,000, and that's one reason why they're in trouble, because they never made those adjustments over the year. Do you know about Idaho?
put your name on the record. For the record, my name is Tom Byerly. I'm Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance with the Employment Department. Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar, Idaho has had a similar situation with California in that they have not raised their taxable wage base. It's not indexed like ours is. And obviously, if you're keeping your wage base down, your collections are going to be down. And in addition to lowering their taxes, they had to significantly cut benefits to workers. And that makes it a less desirable state, frankly, for workers to be in because the benefits aren't as good. So they don't have an effective system as ours. In fact, a U.S. Department of Labor representative went to their meetings when they were talking about their trust fund and basically were pointing to Oregon as a model that they should follow to keep their trust fund solvent.
Thank you. We'll let you go ahead here, Debbie.
Mr. Chairman, I'm actually just at about the end. On page 22, we have a list of the substantive legislation we're putting in, aside from House Bill 2127. Most of this is relatively small fixes to the tax statutes. They may be before your committee, and of course, we'll provide all the information you need on that. And then the last page are the contacts, my number. I'd like to introduce Greg Hickman, the Deputy Director, and Tamara Brickman, our Legislative Coordinator. Any of us, all of us, are very much happy to get you information, talk with you, spend as much time as you need with us. And that wraps up my spiel. Thank you.
A few questions.
Yeah, we got some more questions here. Representative Escobar.
On your advisory council, would you do me a favor and give me a geographical breakdown of where those people come from?
Sure.
That's just a request. You can forward it to my office. We were saying in here that we're reducing administration. You have a 25% potential in the year 2005 for retirement. So the people you've streamlined this process through the employment department for unemployment insurance benefits, and I believe now it's a call-in. You don't even have to go in. Is that correct? And you can you sign up online?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Escobar, yes, you can, and that's a very popular.
So then you're going to reduce your staff through attrition through retirement. That's the plan?
That's the plan.
Okay. The other thing, what's intrigued me was you're online. Let's say Representative Shields is looking for a welder or something of that nature. He gets online with the employment department. Now, once he makes that inquiry, is he able to put himself in a position with that program when a welder comes up that it automatically emails him and lets him know that the welder's there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Escobar, he can do even better than that. He can put in the skills he needs so that even if somebody's job title doesn't read welder, but that person has those skills, a list of people with the appropriate skills will be pulled up, and he can look at that list of people and pull up their resumes and figure out who he wants to interview and who he wants to contact.
Correct. But I mean, if someone new comes in, let's say he was first inquired and he had three, and then Joe Schmuckacoli comes in and he fits his level, will that automatically flag his computer to let him know that that's there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar, I don't think we've got that automatic flagging yet, okay. Though it may be we've got a lot of this is a continually evolving system. What would happen, though, is that our staff who are managing that particular industry would know that that welder is there and would call Representative Shields and let him know that there's somebody else who may qualify. So it's a combination of online and personal services that would get him that welder eventually.
Mr. Chair.
Ms.
Lincoln, this is an elementary question, but is it possible for sole proprietors to participate in the unemployment insurance system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, a sole proprietor is normally not covered because they're just a single entity, obviously, but they can offer coverage for themselves. Most of the time, though, they would incorporate and then as a corporate officer are covered.
They are covered.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? no more questions, I guess. I want to thank you very much for coming today with the presentation, and I'm sure we're going over the next 6 months. We'll see you a number of times. I appreciate the help.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Glad to do it.
The committee, there's a list of bills here that the department is putting out. They may or they may not come to our committee. Like some of them dealing with revenue might probably will just go directly to revenue, but they could come here with a referral to revenue also. And with that, does anybody have anything else? We waited sure. through our first meeting then.
Monday is a state holiday, but the business goes on as usual here, and we do have some state agency people coming for another overview on Monday, so you should have that agenda.
And we will, there's a possibility by next Wednesday have some bills that we can start working on and move into that. And if there's no objection, we are adjourned.